Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with actress and singer Christy Dale Sanders, who plays the role of Madame Giry in the traveling production of The Phantom of the Opera, currently at the Orpheum in San Francisco. Also visiting us in studio is award-winning choral conductor Ragnar Bolin, in his capacity as artistic director of the professional chamber choir Capella SF, sharing details about this coming weekend's concerts. Conductor Michael Morgan also will be in discussion about his upcoming guest appearance with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this Saturday. He'll be leading the orchestra in a program that includes music by Bernstein, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and Max Bruch. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson talks to author Kimberly Lovato about her book that she co-authored, 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die, which happens to be a pledge incentive on today's show. So even though we are in our spring-fall membership campaign, we encourage you to make the call to enjoy the cultural offerings here at KLW to make a pledge of support during our drive. We'll also have some complimentary tickets to give away to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. So stay with us this hour. Lots of interesting conversations ahead. My first guest is one of the cultural treasures of the Bay Area, Ragnar Bolin. He's the conductor of Capella SF, a professional ensemble of some 24 voices. He founded the chamber choir in 2014, and their concerts this Saturday and Sunday is called Crown Jewels of Britain, A Journey Through Centuries of British Music. He began his tenure as chorus director of the San Francisco Symphony in March 2007, and in 2010, the Symphony and Chorus garnered 3 Grammy Awards for their recording of Mahler's Symphony No. 8, including Best Choral Performance under Ragnar's direction. He's appeared regularly on Swedish radio with several ensembles, made his Carnegie Hall debut conducting Brahms' Requiem, and since 2011, he has appeared several times as guest conductor of the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. This year, he made his debut with the BBC Singers, and he currently teaches at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Welcome back to Open Air, Ragnar.
Thank you so much.
Happy to have you. Keeping busy, I see, as always. And congratulations on these Capella SF concerts being chosen by the Chronicle's music critic, Joshua Cosman, as his classical music pick of the week.
It's a great honor.
That's fantastic. Yes. Well, why don't you put your teaching hat on for a moment and give us a crash course in British Choral Music 101. Why is it so important to our musical legacy?
Well, Britain to England today, and Britain today is one of the leading choral countries, choral cultures. They're very strong, and there's so much interesting things going on the contemporary scene today, not the least. What we're doing this weekend is to present an exposé from as early back as the 1400s, starting with John Dunstable's Veni Sancti Spiritus, and then working our way through the centuries, a little bit of a gap in the 1700s, but then working our way up to contemporary, and actually ending the program with 4 contemporary composers, just because there's, as I said, so much interesting things going on.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that gap in the 1700s. Why was that?
Well, there was, for a cappella music in general in Europe at the time, a bit of a gap after the polyphony of the Baroque, when classicism came in. There was a lot of masses written for mainly instruments and voices, so there was a bit of a gap in regards to a cappella music. I think the gap was even worse in England. I'll probably be attacked for this. I'm sure that there is a lot of things there as well. But since I wanted to move up to the contemporary scene, I allowed myself to sort of skip over the 18th century a little bit and choose a few gems from the 19th century where we definitely have some wonderful things.
Well, you mentioned England. I think in England we have to mind the gap anyway, don't we?
Right. The tube. Yes.
Well, with such a wealth of material, how did you decide on what to include in this program?
There is actually a wealth of material. I browsed through things that I knew and things that were new to me. And as always, I'm trying to adhere to whatever program format we have, but always choose what I regard, what I find to my own taste, be the gems, the highlights, the things that really strike a chord with me. And this is what I'm hoping that the audience will find too, that each and every piece in the program is extraordinarily beautiful in and of itself. So it's not just like a history of music lesson that we're sitting through.
Right, right. Well, I understand you got a true taste of England this past July. So.
Right, right. I had the honor of being the judge in a choral composition competition in Canterbury in July.
So that probably gave you a little bit of incentive for how to bring some interpretation to your concerts this coming
weekend. Right, right. I did have a chance to see the great old cathedral there, I believe from the 700s. And it so happens that the Veni Sancti Spiritus text that is set to music by Dunstable in our program is attributed to either Pope Innocentius III or the Archbishop of Canterbury in the 1200s.
Wow. Okay. Well, now you mentioned hearing some of this music in probably where it was composed in the Canterbury Cathedral in some cases. You're in two different venues for these concerts at the Cathedral in Oakland And then the Mission Dolores Basilica on Sunday. How do you have to adapt your interpretation or your subtleties given these two different spaces?
Right, so this is our first time in Cathedral of Christ the Light in Oakland, and we're very excited to be there. It's such a beautiful building. The reverberance in the space is fairly long. I would guess around 7 seconds. So, but it so happens that it fits our program quite well because many of the pieces are suitable to that kind of rich acoustics. One does have to bear those things in mind. In Mission Dolores, it's more like four and a half seconds of reverb. So,
And your ensemble of 24 voices, is that are all the pieces done with full ensemble?
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them will be accompanied by organ. Jerome Lenk, who is the organist of Mission Dolores, will be our organist for this program. Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit more about your ensemble of singers. Have they been with you from the start, many of the voices?
Yes, they have. So, you know, having been here in the Bay Area since 2007, after a few years when we started thinking about Capella SF, I sort of cherry-picked the best voices, the best singers that I found, that I came across, and eventually we formed Capella SF. So it's a little bit of a floating roster dependent on people's availability, but it's many of them are sort of sticking with me and have been in the group since the start.
There's a wonderful opportunities, so many opportunities here in the Bay Area to sing incredible choral music. How are you, as a teacher at the conservatory, finding the younger voices and their willingness to perform ensemble music as opposed to wanting that big solo career?
Yeah, when it comes to the voice students at the conservatory, when you become a voice student, of course, your aim must be to become a soloist. Otherwise, why spend all that time and money to educate yourself? But my angle is to induce in them an understanding that they can broaden their palate just a little bit and also have under their belt an understanding of what is required when it comes to professional ensemble singing, professional choral singing, so that you're also great at that should you in your career choose to do that. Mm-hmm. And I do find there's a great crossover from the conservatory chorus to the San Francisco Symphony Chorus. I have several members now in the symphony chorus that have started out, that we got to know each other back in the conservatory. So I find that bridge really good.
Speaking of the San Francisco Symphony Chorus, while you've been preparing for the concerts this weekend, you've been preparing the San Francisco Symphony Chorus for the Stravinsky Festival being mounted by Michael Tilson Thomas beginning next week. What are the particular challenges in preparing a work like Stravinsky's Persephone?
For this piece, I would say it's the French. It's in French. And we had wonderful help from our accompanist for these rehearsals, Peter Grünberg, who is an expert in many language, diction of many languages, but he's fluent in French, so he's been of great help. Other than that, the Persephone is musically and tonally for the chorus is not all that challenging. It's mostly in regards to the French.
I'm surprised that rhythm isn't more of an issue than given Stravinsky.
Right. There are worse, more difficult pieces by Stravinsky.
And again, if you'd put your professorial hat on once again, for those of us not up to speed on our Greek history, a bit of the story of Persephone and what's being told on stage.
So Persephone, she is the daughter of a goddess who places her in the care of nymphs, and they warn her not to look too deep into the flower of... Oh, help me out.
Anyway,
but she does look into to this flower and gets taken down to the netherworld and then becomes crowned as the queen of the netherworld. Eventually, she's called, summoned back up to our world and then becomes the goddess, I would say, of spring. And it's an old story by Homer that is sort of modified by Stravinsky's collaborator, on which name I'm also blanking at this point, so I wasn't prepared for that.
No, that's all right. I've got part of the press release here, and I just should mention that the part of the Stravinsky Festival will include Persephone with the Firebird as the second half of the program, and that's our the 21st to the 23rd of September, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting with Nicholas Fahn as tenor and Leslie Caron as narrator. Not only the San Francisco Symphony Chorus involved, but the Pacific Boy Choir and the San Francisco Girls Chorus under direction of Andrew Brown and Valerie St. Agathe, respectively. So you're combining these rehearsals with the younger kids. How are you? Do you have to adapt your means and your method in terms of how to get a cohesive sound out of those now four entities?
Yeah, well, they prepare on their own, and then we convene and gather together, which we did for the first time this last Tuesday. And they were, of course, very well prepared already, and Valerie St. Agathe is French, so they had their language under their belt already. It went really well. They're participating in the third out of three movements, so it's a little bit limited time-wise what they do, but they did really well last Tuesday already.
Mm-hmm. sfsymphony.org for more information about those concerts and the other concerts involved with the San Francisco Symphony's Stravinsky Festival coming up. But now back to this weekend's concert. Among the composers being presented are mainstays that we've heard of course, before, Purcell, Vaughan Williams, Gardner, and Elgar, as well as Benjamin Britten, you're including for a more contemporary sound. Jonathan Dove is someone I'm not familiar with. We're going to hear an excerpt of the group singing Seek Him That Maketh the Seven Stars. Tell us a little bit about Jonathan Dove.
He's one of the really interesting composers on the contemporary scene in England today. Very prolific, writes in all genres, but a lot of choral output, and this is one of his masterpieces, I would say.
Let's hear that now, and I thank you, Ragnar, for coming in. Capella SF's concert, Crown Jewels of Britain, can be heard on Saturday at the Cathedral of Christ the Light on Harrison Street in Oakland. That's an 8 p.m. concert. And on Admission Dolores on Sunday at 5 p.m. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Capella SF, under the direction of Ragnar Bolin. Crown Jewels of Britain, a journey through centuries of British music. This Saturday at the Cathedral of Light in Oakland and Sunday at Mission Dolores Basilica. KLW is a media sponsor for that concert, by the way, and you can get more information about that at capellasf.org.
Sleeping baby boy, your mama has a few things left to say. I wish I could heal your broken heart before I go away. Take it in my hands and pour into it all this light surrounding me. Furnish it with wings so you can be free. All these things I want, they tell me are impossible to give.
That is the beautiful voice of Christy Dale Sanders. She plays Madame Giry in the Broadway touring production of The Phantom of the Opera, currently at the Orpheum. She has been seen on Broadway in productions of Cabaret, Evita, Next Fall, The Phantom, of course, Urinetown, and The Sound of Music. Her off-Broadway and regional credits are extensive, and she also co-created and performed several cabarets throughout the United States, performing at Carnegie Hall in My Favorite Broadway Diva, and as soloist for the New Haven Symphony Broadway Pop Series. Christy has also toured Japan and the U.S. with Labor of Love, performed in the 1992 Barcelona Olympics, sung in Germany and Austria with the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber, as well as danced throughout Sweden and Canada. Her TV credits include All My Children and The Wire. You may have heard her in a voiceover or two. And her website is Christy Dale Sanders. A pleasure to talk and welcome Christy to our studios to talk about this touring production. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
Terrific, thank you. And what an exciting thing to be doing such a newly mounted Phantom of the Opera.
It's an amazing production. Yeah, it's...
Where did the tour start?
Well, the tour started actually 5 years ago, way before I even came into it, so...
I think it's been on constant tour since it's been formed.
Well, I did the other tour about, I don't know, 8 years ago by now, I think, and also the Broadway production, which are, they're both the Cameron, they're both Cameron Mackintosh, so, but they're very different from what's on Broadway than what we have out here on tour, and this one has an amazing set. I mean, it's just out there when you come see it. We had a young woman who came last night who said she's seen Phantom of the Opera 20 times and in all different versions.
I don't think I could do that myself.
I don't think I could do that myself.
Well, you're doing it in person.
Yes.
That must be kind of grueling, and you must have to really pace yourself to have the kind of energy that is needed night after night, for knowing that there's, even though that person may have seen it 20 times, there's always that one person that has never had that experience before.
Yeah, I think one of the best advice I got from a director was just know that every night someone is out there having an experience of their lifetime, and then sitting next to them is someone who's losing the will to live. But it doesn't matter. You have to go for the person who is so excited, and we see it every night, especially during the bows, because we can see the audience when we bow, and to see their faces, and to know. I had another woman who came up and said this was a gift that she got 20 years ago, and waiting for Phantom to come to the city that she lived in so she could see it. And she's been holding on to that sort of promise of a ticket for 20 years. So they're out there, those awesome fans.
Wow.
Yeah.
this is obviously a touring production that is well packaged and managed. Have there been any surprises along the way in terms of cities that you've arrived at or venues that are a little bit more unusual than others?
Well, every time we go into a city, it is a surprise, I have to say, because we travel our own set, we travel our own floor. Our production travels in 20 trucks, 20 semis. And so we have a team that goes into the city before we get there. They put down our floor, they put down our electrics. We have a couple of set pieces that are doubled. And then when we come in after they have spent 2 days putting the set in, we come in and try to find where our props are, where our dressing rooms are, where the backstage quick change areas are. And every venue is different. No matter what they tell you, we always get a different sound. We always get a different... some of our houses, we've played up to 2,900 seats to 1,600 seats. So it's always a surprise, especially as now that I'm older, I have to say, touring is a little tricky sometimes.
And I imagine as much as you want to, you know, you may be going to an unfamiliar city, you want to explore a little bit, but you've got to realize that the reason you're there is to be 110% when the curtain goes up.
We do 8 shows a week.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
From here, from San Francisco, where does the tour take you?
We actually have a week off because we have to get all of our trucks across the country to Fort Lauderdale. And it takes that long for them to get those 20 trucks across the country. So that's where we're headed next. And, you know, when you said that, sometimes just finding the stage door is a challenge.
Well, I happen to know two of the Phantoms that were on Broadway and also in London, Marcus Lovett and Frank D'Ambrosio, both have loved their tenure as the Phantom. In this production, the touring production, Quentin Oliver Lee is the Phantom with Ava Tavares as Christine. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your character, Madame Giry.
Madame Giry, well, she basically is, she runs everything, what can I say? She is the ballet mistress, and she has a connection with the Phantom and with Christine. She kind of holds the keys to the opera house. So I sort of like to look at it as, I won't tell you what my backstory is because that would ruin it. but she's very dark and she cares a lot about her ballerinas and she cares a lot about the Phantom. And she's got a special connection to Christine. And she also has a daughter, Meg Giry, who is Christine's best friend. And so they... she sort of takes care of everything and makes sure everything is okay, and yet she's very disturbed by the Phantom's hold over everyone and some of his bad behavior.
Well, I wish you a wonderful tour. It's running through the 20th at the Orpheum Theater here in San Francisco and beyond. SHNSF.com for more details. We should also mention that the local... ice creamery Humphrey Slocum has created a special concoction for this opera, Phantom of the Opera. The Phantom of the Opera inspired ice cream sundae, and it's a rich fudge brownie topped with a heavenly serving of course, French vanilla ice cream. But according to the press release, just like Cameron McIntosh's new take on this Broadway classic, Humphrey Slocum introduces a modern spin through their exclusive house-made rose-infused hot fudge, which cloaks the tasty juxtaposition of flavors. Humphrey Slocum's special flavor for the Phantom of the Opera. Go figure out. Hope you can catch that in between your shows.
I will try.
Here's the classic music of the night from Phantom of the Opera. Thanks for coming in, Christy.
Thank you.
Gently, night unfurls its splendor. Grasp it, sense it, tremulous and tender. Turn your face away from the garish light of day. Turn your thoughts away from cold, unfeeling light. And listen to the music of the night.
Phantom of the Opera through the 30th of September here in San Francisco. My thanks for Christy Dale Sanders as Madame Giry for coming in. Well, another one of the Bay Area treasures that we are fortunate to have around here in San Francisco is the conductor Michael Morgan. He's for some two decades and more has been the director of the Oakland Symphony Orchestra. And I've had the pleasure of both watching and performing with this conductor for several concerts. He is passionate about educating young musicians both here in the Bay Area and around the country, and a proud product of the public schools of Washington, D.C. He started conducting at the ripe old age of 12 and counts Gunther Schuller, Seiji Ozawa, and Leonard Bernstein among his mentors. This Saturday, he is guest conductor for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony in music by Bernstein, Max Bruch, Mozart, and Tchaikovsky. Yesterday, he stopped by the studio for a talk. I'll have that conversation in just a moment, but not before I remind you that we are here at KLW in the midst of our fall membership campaign, encouraging you to step up for KLW, for its arts programming. Perhaps you heard an interesting conversation on this very program that you'd like to show appreciation for. Go to kalw.org or call 800-525-9917 and make your pledge of support there. As you've been hearing throughout the day, if you tuned to KLW and you seem to love to tune to KLW, thank you for doing that. Every entry gets and every call, whether you pledge or not, gets an entry into a special giveaway for the 20th anniversary of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll give you airfare and hotel accommodations in Chicago for this October event. All the contest details are at kalw.org. Now that conversation, as promised, with Michael Morgan. Always a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves, Maestro.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start by backing up a bit and the Bear Valley Music Festival, for which you're artistic director, 50 years old this year. Not you, but the festival is. How many of those years have you been involved?
This was my fourth, I believe. Either fourth or fifth, but I think it's fourth. And it's a wonderful festival with a classical-sized chamber orchestra. Except when we expand, as we did this year, because we expanded and did things like the Beethoven Ninth in our tent with I brought soloists from down here and in the Bay Area, but the chorus came from up there in Sonora. They put together a community chorus just for the occasion.
How many pieces did they get up to? How many voices did
they
get
up to? Oh, it wasn't very big at all, but then the orchestra was very small, so it's not as though they needed 1,000 people. I think they were at 40 or 50, something like that for the chorus. And I think all the Beethoven symphonies work incredibly well with chamber orchestra anyway, so I was totally happy with those numbers. But the whole thing was wonderful apart from all the smoke from the fires. The fires were nowhere near us, but the smoke most certainly was. And on some days we had to actually shorten rehearsal because you couldn't concentrate because just of the amount of smoke in the air.
Oh, wow. And among those soloists that you assembled was our friend and a frequent guest on Open Air, as well as a soloist here in the Bay Area, Eugene Brancoviano.
Yes, and Seanette Zulker, and they were really great soloists, and I used them not only for the Beethoven Ninth, but, you know, when you have people up that far away, because Bear Valley is pretty remote, you use them for everything you can. So a few nights before, we did a combination opera Broadway program with the orchestra, and then the Beethoven Ninth a couple days later, and it was all really great success.
Fantastic. And also you premiered a new work by David Conte.
Yes, David Conte. We did wrote a cello concerto for Emile Milan, who is, of course, a member of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. And Emile is a favorite up there at the festival anyway, but David's writing, being so cinematic and lyrical, Bear Valley is a basically resort community with people, a lot of people with second homes who live down here in the Bay Area, but it's mostly for about skiing in the winter. So not exactly a place where people go to hear new music. And so for a piece brand new music to be such a big hit there was really quite an achievement. And I hope Emile will that we'll get it played down here with one or another of the orchestras here in the Bay Area.
Well, we'll keep our ears peeled for that. And then, of course, August saw the official 100th birthday of Leonard Bernstein. Some in the musical world has been celebrating all year, many organizations, and with good cause. You have a very special connection to Leonard Bernstein. Tell us how you first got acquainted with Lenny and your relationship.
We met in 1977 at Tanglewood when I was a student there, and our paths continued to cross then for the rest of his life. I think the last time was either at the Chicago Symphony when he guest conducted there for a couple of weeks, or might have been in New York. My most vivid sort of final memory of Leonard Bernstein is sitting in the Avery Fisher, it's now called something else. Yes, sitting in Avery Fisher with
David several, Geffen Hall.
Geffen, that's yeah. Right. Sitting with several other people trying to decide where the offstage brass of the Mahler II should be. So I think that might have been the last thing I saw him was at that Mahler II rehearsal. Maybe I don't know. You know, getting old, you get the chronology mixed up a lot.
You must have a favorite anecdote, at least that you can share with our public radio audience about Lenny.
My favorite is actually the story I tell all the time is of meeting him, because I was a student at Tanglewood. I was 19. He and Schulte had always been my idols before I met either of them. And we were at Tanglewood as students in 1977. We were not promised even a moment with Leonard Bernstein. He wasn't scheduled to be with us. But he was on campus, and we had a reading scheduled with the student orchestra, which I noticed was unusually early. And then the Boston Symphony rehearsal that he was leading that day was unusually late. So I thought there was at least a window, so there was at least a chance that he might show up, but they didn't tell us anything. And I went first. I was doing Beethoven 7th. And he walked in a couple minutes before I was supposed to start, wearing all white, everything white, just the really brilliant white outfit he had on, and looking extremely unhappy to be there, because it's just like it's just not a morning person in that at that point.
I don't think ever.
I do not blame him. But so I started, so he walked in and sat over behind the cellos, and I did the first one of the Beethoven 7th. And as anyone knows who's ever heard Bernstein, if he likes something, he raves about it in the absolutely the most just
over
ridiculous.
The top, yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's the greatest thing that ever happened in the world at that to that point. So he was up raving about what I had just done with the orchestra, about several aspects of the Beethoven. And my most vivid memory was of I was sitting on a rehearsal stool on the podium, and my most vivid memory is of the lit cigarette that he had draped. He was draped his left arm around my shoulders, and the lit cigarette that was very near my left ear. So it was very hard to concentrate on what he was saying. I didn't want to be burned by the cigarette, but that is how I met Leonard Bernstein.
I remember hearing a similar anecdote, or at least a cigarette anecdote of Lenny Bernstein, where you know a young budding assistant conductor was standing next to him, and he has a cigarette that's about to, the ashes are about to drop, and the assistant pulls out of his pocket at one of those portable ashtrays, and Lenny says, "That kid's gonna go far." Any new or interesting Bernstein performances that you've witnessed this stellar anniversary year?
Well, you know, when you get as sort of old and crotchety as I am, and you've seen loads of Schulte, loads of Bernstein, loads of Abbado and Tenstedt and all these people, you don't go to concerts much anymore because all of your favorite conductors have passed on. So I don't actually see very many concerts at all anymore. It's just I take it as one of my several missions to just do as much of the music as I possibly can of Bernstein. Mm-hmm. And so actually one of the things I'm looking forward to most on this season, and there are lots of things, we're doing a Bernstein piece on almost every concert during this whole next season. We started with the Serenade at the end of last season, so we're doing an entire year of saluting the Bernstein Centennial. But we're doing Songfest with Adler Fellows because I have for years been trying to do Songfest, and it never was the right time, or it takes a lot of soloists, it's very expensive to put on, but so on. I had planned the entire season and was ready to go to press when Sherry Greenwald called me from the San Francisco Opera Center and said, you know, several of our kids have learned quite a bit of this Bernstein Songfest. Is there any way you can program it? And so finally, here's my chance to do the Bernstein Songfest, which I've been trying to do for years. So I threw something off of a program. And so next
March,
we mm-hmm. do the Bernstein Songfest.
Nice.
On a program that was actually originally going to be about more women. I mean, it still has Symphony by Louise Farranc on it, and if you don't know the music of Louise Farranc, you certainly should. She's
absolutely.
A mid-19th century French composer who utterly fantastic composer that people do not know nearly enough.
Do you know her chamber music of a beautiful work for flute, cello, and piano? It's a trio that's just out of this world.
I don't know. I know some other chamber. I don't know that particular piece. Every piece of music of hers I run into is just incredible.
And she was one of those amazing women at the Paris Conservatory who, witnessing her success around Europe, insisted to the Paris Conservatory powers that be that she be paid on an equal scale.
Oh, yeah. I tell that story about her. She's the beginning of the equal pay movement. Once she had a success with one of her pieces, and she insisted and got equal pay to her to her colleagues.
Well, you seem far from burned out on Bernstein, as you'll be continuing the party this coming spring with Songfest and a concert version of West Side Story in May. Closer on the calendar, this coming Saturday's concert with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony will feature 3 dance variations from Fancy Free, and your first Oakland Symphony concert will include the dance episodes from On the Town. Let's first talk about this Saturday's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony concert,
sure.
for which you return as guest conductor, and now I need to have, with full disclosure, mention that I'm a member of that fair orchestra in the flute section, and it's such a pleasure to work with you once again.
I really like that orchestra. I consider that sort of my second favorite orchestra. So it's really
wow.
it's enormously fun, and I was talking to one of my colleagues in the Oakland Symphony about another sort of volunteer/community-type orchestra that I was working with at that time. It was up doing the Camellia Orchestra up in Sacramento. And we were talking about how, her word for it was healing, it is to work with a really devoted community or amateur orchestra, because everyone is there just because they love to play music. And so the feeling in the room is just tremendous every time you do it. And then, you know, this is like the third time I've been with Rainbow.
I think so, yeah.
And, you know, I came to see a Rainbow Symphony concert because Don Harms, who is one of my concert masters at Oakland, was the new music director, so I thought I would come and see it. Had no expectations at all. And I heard the orchestra, and I really liked the orchestra, and I said to Don, you know, I could do concerts with this orchestra. And so we have, since then, this is the third time I've been there.
Very nice.
And I've enjoyed every single time.
And Dawn's been working with you up at Bear Valley, too, right?
That's right. Dawn is our, she's done other things with us, too, but if you ever have a chance to see the children's program that Dawn does, she's been doing it for years, but it because of the elements of both improvisation and children participating, it's literally the best program for young people I've ever seen. So we never get tired of it. And this is the fourth year I've been there, and it's the fourth year we've had her come up and do it. And the kids come year after year to see this program, and you know, she feels compelled to try to change it because, you know, she knows we've heard it before, but honestly, she doesn't need to change a note because of the. Literally, the kids participate, and when the kids participate, including a wonderful bit on composition, where the kids put 5 notes randomly on a staff, and Dawn on violin and I on piano, we turn it into a piece of music. So, 5 different kids put a note wherever they want on the staff, and we turn it into music. Sometimes so hilarious I can't play. I'm laughing so much. But it's great every single year.
And part of that success is due to Dawn's ebullience.
Dawn is just amazing. A fantastic violinist, fantastic person. It's just a great bundle of energy to be around.
Well, I mentioned the Bernstein on this program Saturday. Also on the program, Tchaikovsky's Capriccio Italien, Mozart's 36th Symphony, not heard as often as others, written by the 27-year-old Wolfgang during a stopover in the Austrian town of Linz on his way back home to Vienna from Salzburg.
Well, I did that because I was talking to Dawn about what I should play, and she said they hadn't done a Haydn or Mozart symphony because generally in a community setting like that, you use as many people as possible all the time so everybody gets to play. So you don't do a lot of the classical repertory, and I thought, okay, then we'll do a Mozart symphony. And I chose that one because it's the middle of the road from Mozart. They're all masterpieces at that point, but some of them are not very difficult, and some of them then are wildly difficult, and the Linz falls right in the middle. So I decided to take that one on.
Mm-hmm. And violinist Andrew Swords will be the soloist for Max Bruch's Scottish Fantasy. Looking at his schedule, he's all over the map these days. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and this is a piece that I've always wanted to do and just never gotten around to. So that's great. That's the other thing that's been true, I think, of almost every Rainbow Symphony concert I've done. I've gotten to put in something that I've always wanted to do and just never get around to.
Mm-hmm. That concert, once again, this coming Saturday at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Always a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves. You're now in what year as music director of the Oakland Symphony?
This is going into, I believe, it's year 28.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Well, that's
a long time.
And that's a great way to build an orchestra with that kind of those number of years. I'm sure you've seen it grow tremendously.
It and the city that holds it. Oakland is changing so fast that I think the greatest challenge that we have basically as the Oakland Symphony is reintroducing ourselves, or introducing ourselves, I should say, to all the new people as the population changes and turns over, and hanging on to what is Oakland about Oakland, so we don't let the character slip away from the town in the course of all this turning over.
Mm, indeed. Well, that full season of the Oakland Symphony gets underway on October 12th with another distinguished soloist, pianist Richard Goodyear, for Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto in a concert theme of Reclaiming My Time. Talk to us about how you and the marketing wizards come up with these titles.
Actually, you know, I am the last person that wants to come up with titling concerts. But I believe what happened was that concert had been declared reclamation just because of both Shostakovich and Rachmaninoff were returning to returning after being sort of knocked off their game a bit. Shostakovich by the Fourth Symphony.
Oh, right.
And Rachmaninoff by some of his, I mean, he went in and out of his failures as a composer. He's one of those people that we appreciate much more now, I think, than we did at the time. So both of them were coming off of bad periods, which is why I got to be called Reclamation, which I didn't much see the connection to. But then when I was in that meeting, I was saying how we need to be doing something that reminds people who pay attention to current events of voting. And so we changed it to Reclaiming My Time because that's, of course, you use that on the floor of the House, so famously done by Maxine Waters when you, you know, after you've given someone, yielded to someone to allow them to make an interjection. But that whole Reclaiming My Time video went viral with Maxine Waters. And so I put it there just to remind people that the most important thing that any of us has to do in this half of the year of 2018 is to vote.
That's for sure, yeah. Also on this first concert on October 12th, Shostakovich 5th, we mentioned the Bernstein dances from On the Town. In November, the theme is a Requiem for Ghost Ship, appropriately titled, on which you'll be offering the premiere of Richard Marriott's Ghost Ship Concerto for cello and orchestra, featuring cellist Matthew Linneman.
Yes, I was approached by a wonderful donor about commissioning that piece from Mr. Marriott, a cello concerto, and we landed on Matthew, whom I've worked with before. I know him even back when he was a student at the San Francisco Conservatory. He's, in fact, also my soloist when I go to the Reno Chamber Orchestra, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. but in any case, it's written, just the composer and the donor were both just very touched as everyone was by the tragedy of the Ghost Ship fire, which pretty much everybody in the Oakland arts community knows somebody that was lost in that fire. So I did that and decided to pair it with the Brahms Requiem. And then I'm opening that concert with the Bernstein Take Care of This House from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, one of the most beautiful songs Bernstein wrote. And obviously Take Care of This House is, you know, ties in very nicely with the Honoring the Ghost Ship theme.
We should mention that the commission was by Roger Arvid Anderson and Richard Marriott's a composer, performer, producer, and instrument builder for some 30 years now. He's also a founder and artistic director of the Clubfoot Orchestra, which performs live music for silent films. And they'll be performing an all-day retrospective for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival this September at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. Of course, you'll want to go to the daytime screening so you can catch the Bars concert in the evening.
That's right. It's all on Saturday. You'll be very busy on Saturday.
December witnesses your annual Let Us Break Bread Together concert, this themed swing and soul. Always a fun time for that one, too.
Very much so. And we're honoring Fats Domino and Nina Simone this year. It's always a Christmas concert, so you will always hear Sleigh Ride. You will always hear the Hallelujah Chorus. But we then always have a secondary subject of people that we want to honor, people recently lost, and all in choral versions of their famous songs. So that's always a fun day.
Well, let's have you back to talk about the spring season when it comes upon us.
Absolutely.
And we wish you a pleasant experience this coming Saturday with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for coming in, Michael.
Thank you.
With a little bit of Tchaikovsky in the background, we are offering 3 pairs of complimentary tickets to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this Saturday evening at 8 if you call 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134 for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this Saturday evening at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air. And if you are so incentivized to offer a donation to KLW by calling 800-525-9917, we're going to offer you this next segment's book. It's 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die. Co-author Kimberly Lovato now in conversation with Peter Robinson about that book. Peter, welcome.
Hi, David. And good Kimberly. To be here, and welcome, Kimberly, to the studio. And I'm looking at the very attractive cover on this book, 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die, and I see the cable car in amongst the big O's and the one of the 100. And I know just before we came on, you were talking about taking your niece on the cable car. So what was that trip like?
Yeah, my niece is from Los Angeles, where I am originally from, you know, so there are no cable cars in Los Angeles. So she flew up for a special weekend with her aunt, Kimberly, and I took her on a cable car, and she loved it. But one of the things that I was doing was explaining to her how they run, and they're attached to these cables that actually run under the city, which is a little conceptually a little hard to understand. You know, certainly our hills are hard to understand for Angelenos, and so I took her to the Cable Car Museum afterwards. And if you haven't been there, it's a fascinating place. You can actually see the cables churning and feel the vibration, as you know, and hear the noise. And it suddenly came to life for her, and I loved being able to take her to this really unique part of San Francisco history and have her actually, you know, just viscerally react to it. So that was a lot of fun. That was a few years ago. Now I need to get my youngest niece up here and do the same.
Good. And I like the title, 100 Things, because in fact, for every page, there's like 10 extra things to do. So it's like 1,000 things to
That's
do
right.
in San Francisco. And you've got bookstores, you've got theaters, you've got restaurants. Certainly one of my favorite pastimes is browsing in bookstores. So do you have any special bookstores that you frequent?
Well, I frequent Book Passage quite a bit because they are my closest bookstore. But one of my favorites is out on Clement Street, and it's Green Apple Books. And I really am one of those old dinosaurs, I guess, because I love the smell of books, old books in bookstores. And they have a section for used books and new books, and I love going there and browsing. You know, Booksmith on Haight Street is great.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're speaking, in fact, tonight at Book Passage in Sausalito,
that's
is that right?
Right? Yep, yeah. Jill and I will be there tonight.
Yeah, so there's two authors, Kimberly, who we're speaking to now, and then Jill Robinson. And in terms of travel writing, these are people who've trotted around the globe. So what they're actually doing here is writing a book which is good for residents of San Francisco, but it's also good if you have guests staying in your house and you want to spread the word. And sometimes you make unusual discoveries, even as a travel writer in the city in which you live. Has that happened to you?
Oh, yes. So we did write this book, of course, for travelers to San Francisco, but we really wanted to put a few surprises in there for residents, too. So Jill literally wrote 50, and I literally wrote 50. So we shared it, and she came up with Lotta's Fountain. And honestly, I had never heard of it.
And where is that, just for people who haven't heard of it?
Yeah, so it's on Market Street, about where Kearney and Geary meet Market Street, on this pedestrian island. And it's a 24-foot fountain painted bronze with these griffins and lions and other ornamental attachments to it, and I've probably walked by it 1,000 times, and until Jill mentioned it, I had never heard of it. And, you know, one of the reasons we decided to put it in is, of course, we can't go into its long history, but it is the oldest landmark in San Francisco. It was around before the 1906 earthquake, and I did what I want people to do. I went and looked it up. I went and looked up that it was named for Lotta Crabtree, this vaudeville singer, and that it's a gathering place for, it was a gathering place after the earthquake for people to meet. And still today, on April 18th at 5:12 a.m. when that earthquake hit, they still commemorate by meeting there. And I don't think there are any survivors of the 1906 earthquake anymore, but when there were, which wasn't that long ago in the 2000s, they still met there. And that was a fascinating discovery for me, and also another part of San Francisco history that's still alive.
Now, one thing I particularly like about the book is that it's a manageable size. So it's a printed book. You're not having to do any electronics. It'll fit in your backpack. It's got endlessly good suggestions. And I think it's a user-friendly book because you can find those areas of interest that appeal to you specifically. And I'm thinking about crossing the Golden Gate Bridge. I know it's about San Francisco, but you do have something about Angel Island in there, don't you?
We definitely do. We have not only, you know, crossing the bridge, we suggest getting out of town. San Francisco has some great day trips, but Angel Island, for sure. It's the biggest island in the bay, and being that San Francisco is surrounded by water, we encourage people to get out on the water. It's a great place to see the city. It's a great place to, again, check into local history, and Angel Island, for me, has always been a place where I've gone to ride my bike and hike. I used to take my daughter to Angel Island to ride her bike, and I remember...
And, of course, you've got the ferry ride. I mean, let's not forget that.
Well,
I mean,
of course, that's how you get there, unless you're swimming, Peter, which I am not. You're taking a ferry. Yeah, the ferry's an awesome way to see San Francisco and the views, and Angel Island's fantastic, not only for the hiking and biking, but the immigration station that's there, and definitely...
Now, I should add that this book, 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die, is on special offer here for donators to KLW. And the number here at KLW to call is 800-525-9917. It's a thank you gift to all our listeners. And we are here for you. Can you also be here for us? So let's go back to you for a second. The actual donation is well, $100 donation, and you will get your individual copy of Kim Novak and Jill Robinson's book, 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die. So you've done a lot of travel writing beyond. Tell me, where are you going to next?
Next, I am going to Vietnam and Cambodia. So that's, I just got back from France, so I got back on Saturday, so I'm a little jet-lagged.
Okay.
And then I'm here for a month, so promoting the book and doing lots of signings and readings, and then I'm off for an assignment to Vietnam and Cambodia.
Okay, but you're going to be at Book Passage in Sausalito tonight.
Yep.
And then next week, where are you?
Next week, I am at Books, Inc. on Chestnut Street in the Marina, And we will be up at the Napa Valley Book Fest on October 6th with a table there. So that's what we have lined up for now.
And if you had one place in particular in San Francisco, here we go.
This is a
tough question.
Always.
What would be where we should all meet and see you?
Meet and see me. Well, I love being outdoors, and I think San Francisco is a great place to be outdoors. So I love the western side of the city, you know, Sutro Baths, the coastal trail there, the Land's End Trail that goes up to Legion of Honor. I just think it's such a beautiful part of San Francisco that maybe a lot of visitors don't get to because it's out there, unless they go to the Cliff House or something like that. So I was just out there the other day at Outer Lands for brunch, meeting Jill, as a matter of fact, and I just love it out there. It's so beautiful.
So you're a great walker. You know, get out a good pair of walking shoes. Be prepared to go uphill as well as downhill. And tell me, if you had to leave your heart somewhere, where would you leave your heart?
Oh, that's a tough question, but a good one.
San Francisco.
San Francisco, of course.
Okay. Well, here we go, and here's that magic moment. Tell us about it, Count Basie.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you, Peter. And for a $100 gift to KALW, 100 things to do in San Francisco before you die can be yours as a thank you gift. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW, joined now by Eli Wirtschafter.
Hey, David.
To offer your incentive to make that phone call. 100 things to do in San Francisco before you die. Perhaps give it to a friend that you want to entice out to San Francisco. I don't know what the deal about the before you die thing, but they'll certainly enjoy
it. I do know that you have many opportunities to donate to KALW before you die, but this may be the only time when you can get this book. Call us in the newsroom. Call us at KALW at 1-800-525-9917. Support local radio, support local programming, bring in authors talking about things relevant to you. You can also go to KALW.org to make that donation.
800-525-9917. If you'd prefer or are not able to donate at the moment, you have the incentive of being entered in a drawing just by making the call. No donation required to get tickets, including airfare and accommodations in Chicago for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me's 20th anniversary show with Peter Sagal. 800-525-9917. All the contest details are at klw.org. But we're hoping you perhaps have, I think, a dollar for each one of the 100 things to do in San Francisco before you die is a good price, don't you?
I would say so.
There you go.
$100, 100 things to do.
Yeah.
That's $1 per thing. That's a really great value.
I think so. 800-525-9917. If you're able to offer that gift of $100, Kimberly Lovato and Jill Robinson's book, 100 Things to Do Before You Die in San Francisco. Yours is a modest thank you gift for supporting this local public radio station. Thanks, Eli.
Thank you, David.
KLW.org is the place to do it as well. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Our shows are archived at KALW.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing today's show. Any comments about the show are welcome to me personally by email, david@kalw.org. 800-525-9917 to offer a donation. Thanks to Jonathan Cooner in Berkeley, as well as Tahir Naeem in Santa Clara, who made donations this hour. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco.